You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
The ANC government's decision to simply ban beach access demonstrates, certainly to me, something of a lazy and thinly veiled hostile attitude towards more creative problem solving required to battle the scourge of COVID-19. It has hallmarks that are very similar to the booze and the tobacco ban. Our reader of Business Day commented that here we are in Komiki, restricted to the walkways along the coastline to watch the sunset, blotted by an almost daily flotilla of poaching boats sitting 50 meters from the shore in full face of all the citizens demonstrating a blatant middle finger to the rule of law, and the police, well, only found during the day to flush surfers out of the water, but nowhere to be seen in the evening when the real crime is on full display. Now I'm joined by Shane Cricker, director at Worksmen's Attorneys. Shane, welcome. You issued a note on this the other day that went viral. Firstly, how is it that the state of disaster can continue being extended in perpetuity without seeking parliament approval?
Well, that's the way that the Disaster Management Act is drafted, unfortunately. It says that the Minister of Cooperative Governance can extend the state of disaster monthly, and there's no limit on how many times she can do that. So it's extended in perpetuity. You know, as we point out in the article, if South Africa were at war and a state of emergency had been declared, that state of emergency would have expired after 21 days. And the extension of the emergency until now would have required three separate approvals by Parliament. But we're sitting in a situation where we've had 10 months now of laws being passed under these regulations without the people who we voted into Parliament having had any say at all. It is arguable that the state of disaster amounts to a state of emergency, and that therefore it's illegal until it's been, or unconstitutional until it's been reviewed by Parliament. But you can see, based on the cases that have been taken to court, that people are hesitant to do that because it just takes too long.
I mean, it does require some testing to gain legal precedent here. But as you say, we have been unable to get that kind of precedent to date. Now, I want to move on to the issue of the beaches. It's a very bizarre situation where you have Professor Shabir Mahdi, for example, who was part of the Ministerial Advisory Committee, saying that the very thing we should be doing is actually encouraging people to head outdoors, and beaches are one of the safest spots that we can be. I mean, obviously, apart from a New Year's mass gathering, when you look through the regulations and the way they've been amended, how can citizens go and now access the ocean if they can't walk along the beach?
I think it's interesting that vitamin D is one of the things that we're told is good for us, and that exercise also boosts our immune system. So you would think that the regulations should be interpreted in a way that allows us to get exercise wherever we can. The previous set of regulations didn't have a definition of beach. They simply said that the beach was closed. And so we looked to environmental law to find what the definition of beach was. And that definition then excluded anything that wasn't sand. So the definition of beach has now been amended to say, and it's not particularly well drafted, but it says that it's the sandy, pebbly or rocky shore between the high water mark and the low water mark, and then also within 100 meters of the high water mark. And it seems that the intention is to include any sea, any part of the sea that is also within that 100 meters. What's interesting about that, though, is that it means that the sea that is beyond 100 meters out is open and is not closed. And so what we say in our article is that if there is a portion of sea out there that is open, you have to have a way to get to that sea, and therefore you can't read the regulations to say that the entire coastline is blocked. Or if you do, then you must have a right to traverse the part that's closed in order to get to the part that is open.
And it's an important point, because what we've seen is the arrest of surfers. I mean, it's gone that far.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is that I've seen some of the summons that have been issued, and none of them have been issued for what is actually the only arrestable offence in the regulations. And I use offence in inverted commas because it's not even actually an offence. What the regulations say is the whole purpose of the regulations is to govern gatherings, because those are seen to be the dangerous event. If you have multiple people sitting on the beach, obviously there's a chance of them passing the virus from one to another. Although it says beaches are closed, it isn't an offense to be on the beach. The offense is if you are asked by a police officer to disperse a gathering, then the persons, in plural, who are asked to disperse, if they refuse, not fail to disperse, but if they refuse to disperse, then the police can take further action, which presumably could include an arrest subject to the Criminal Procedure Act. And so most of the summons that we've seen being issued are not being issued for people refusing to disperse, because you'll know that if a policeman comes and tells you to get off the beach, you're likely to comply. This has been interpreted by the police to say that you can't surf, kite surf, windsurf, whatever it is, and that doesn't seem to be consistent with the regulations. Having said that, we are seeing some movement amongst the police, and we have been trying to discuss these things with them, and we hope that they will start to see the regulations for what they are.
Yeah, poor training is one of the root causes of this very often, the misinterpretation of regulations. When we contextualize this in the broader global conversation around COVID-19, how have other countries dealt with this?
Well, a lot of countries closed their beaches initially, across Europe and across Asia and the rest of the world as well. Australia is a good example because, I think what's important here to bear in mind is that this is not just a case of stopping people from doing something that they like doing. There's a whole economy that's linked into beach access and tourism and hospitality and everything that goes with it. And a country like Australia relies on the beaches. So what they did in Australia is that they had a no-towel rule that was introduced in some states, which basically said you can walk on the beach, run on the beach, surf off the beach, but you can't stop and put your towel down because that will result in gatherings and infection spread. And then at Bondi Beach, which is famous amongst surfers, they actually created a taped-off area of the beach that allowed surfers to traverse the beach to get into the water. And then they had somebody monitoring the access so they could see that there weren't too many people going on. And I think those are both sort of sensible ideas. I know in South Africa, initially it was said, well, we don't have the resources to do that sort of manning of the beaches. But if you go to, Sunset Beach, Bloberg today, you'll see police monitoring the beaches at every entrance. So I think we do. And we also have lifesavers who are also capable of fulfilling this function.
And I think that's the most important point here. The consequences of these beach closures, it's not just disgruntled surfers. You're talking about these towns that really rely on the beaches for their livelihoods, for the local economy. And as you've just pointed out, there are much more sensible and far more creative ways of dealing with this than just a blanket ban or a shutdown. Shane Cricker, Director at Worksmen's Attorneys.